You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for joining me. The subject tonight is the comedy of Mort Saul, and my guest is James Curtis. James Curtis is the author of several fine biographies distinguished by their depth. We last spoke with James Curtis after the publication of his biography of Spencer Tracy. He's also written books on W.C. Fields, Preston Sturges, William Cameron Menzies, and James Whale. And I just finished reading his latest book, Last Man Standing, Mort Saul and the Birth of Modern Comedy. James Curtis, welcome back to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you, Gary.
So, how was it writing about a guy who's still alive and working?
Well, it was an interesting experience. It was kind of a stretch for me because I had never had the luxury of being able to get my subject on the telephone if I had a question. And I figured also that Mort would be a difficult subject, either living or deceased, because he was famously a very difficult guy to get along with at times. And I had this idea a number of years before I actually acted on it, and one of the reasons was that I was sure that he would be difficult at best and perhaps belligerent over the notion of someone digging into his life and asking a lot of nosy questions. And I think maybe the fact that I waited as late as I did, he had mellowed considerably and was more agreeable to doing it, although it was certainly a bumpy process at times.
Did you find him to be difficult?
I think at first he's a naturally suspicious guy, and I think at first he was particularly wary of where I was going with this and how I was going to do it. I assured him that I intended to do a balanced job with it because I found the story to be exceedingly interesting, and I think over time he decided that I was okay, and at some point that he would pretty much answer anything that I asked him. And so we settled into a comfortable pattern toward the latter half of the process, where I think he opened up on a lot of subjects, and it was really a great experience. I enjoyed it very much. Challenging. He's not an easy subject, getting across the importance of his life and career and exactly what he did to further, really further the art form, as we could put it, was something that was worth telling, and I'm very happy that I was able to do it.
Oh, well, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
I met him once a few years ago, and he didn't strike me as particularly friendly, but I think maybe he's shy. Is he a shy person?
Yeah, I think he is. He was always, especially when he first started out, he was extremely, he was extremely reticent to get up on stage, and he had to evolve this persona, this onstage persona, to really get past that. And that's one of the early portions of the book, is how he was able to develop his style of delivery. Part of that just came from an absolute fear that the audience wasn't going to laugh, and so he just kind of barreled ahead. And in time, because he was appearing so often in jazz clubs, where really he was in most all cases the first spoken word act in a particular club's history, that he was extremely influenced by the musicians that he worked with. And so the cadences that you see and the way he puts lines and bits of business together really changed with every performance. It depended upon the mood of the room and how each individual audience responded. And I think over time he developed a kind of improvisational way of delivering the material, which was not so much preparation as immersion in the public affairs and news of the day, and how he could process that in his mind and bring it out in a way that was unusual, if not unique.
Well, I was a little surprised when I saw that you'd written a book about Mort Saul because of the Well, I mean, you've chosen a kind of eclectic group of people to write about, but most of them are known for their work in film, which, although Mort Saul is an actor, he's not known for that. What is it that you look for in a person that makes you want to write a book about them?
I think somebody who's been influential, somebody who hasn't been done before, or if he or she, he, I should say, I haven't done any women, that he has perhaps not been done well before. If there's a larger point to be made about their life and work, I think also I have to have an appreciation of their work. I don't want to be stuck with somebody for 3 or 4 years working on a project like this and not caring about what they did or how they did it. In each case, and I've been pretty fortunate in the subjects I've been able to tackle, in that in all cases, there are people who I think I discovered in my youth. Mort, I know, I first became familiar with in 1966 on Los Angeles television, and people like that stick with you, and especially when you go back as an adult and resample, re-engage with these people. The ones that last and resonate are the ones that I think are worth writing about. In Mort's case, I was thinking of moving away from film-related topics, and although the movies are kind of a theme in his book because of the influence they had on him, it was my intent to try to do something that was not related specifically to filmmaking, and I was happy to do it. It's a current event story. It's a political story. It's there's a lot of history involved in terms of the figures that run through the story, so it was a nice stretch, I think, for me, apart from the fact that he was also still living, and I'm not used to having that.
So, Mort Saul was a comedian, a stand-up comedian, I guess. He's before him, were there monologists who delivered comedy in the way he did?
No, I think he was absolutely unique in that regard. If you are looking for, say, a missing link between, say, Will Rogers and maybe Bob Hope and Mort Saul, you've got to go plumbing the depths of people like Lord Buckley, for instance, who was very much influenced by the music. At the same time, he wasn't political in the least. Tom Lehrer, who was a musical act, was certainly topical and satirical, but he did not stand up on stage with just a microphone and a newspaper and do what he did. He had a tremendous amount of prepared material to work through. I think Mort was different in that he dared to get up in front of a nightclub audience and not do mother-in-law jokes and my wife is so fat and that sort of thing, not do the Catskills influenced Henny and style of delivery. He also broke the mold in terms of not wearing a tuxedo that was pretty much a standard issue wardrobe in those days for nightclub comics. Mort said early on, it's actually Enrico Benducci who ran The Hungry Eye who got him to lose the suit and tie, and Mort said that he started thinking about who would ruminate on subjects like this, and so he came up with a kind of grad student persona, which kind of influenced how he spoke on stage and how he reacted on stage. Pullover sweater, open collar, loafers. That wasn't done before. And when he started to move out beyond San Francisco, he invariably found a platform in the jazz clubs around the country. Storyville in Boston, Mr. Kelly's in Chicago, Basin Street East in New York City, etc. Down here in Los Angeles, the Crescendo and the Interlude. In all cases, these were music venues, and when he opened them up and showed that he could actually draw better than the musical acts could, in most cases, He opened and paved the way for others to follow. So after Mort had come in to say, Mr. Kelly's or Storyville, then Shelley Berman could come in, Mike Nichols and Elaine May could come in, other progressive acts could come in, and they had an entirely different way of presenting themselves than what audiences were used to. They were truly the post-war trend in comedy, in satire, in observational humor, and I think nothing's been the same since.
Well, you describe him as having that grad student look. What was he? I mean, how old was he when he first performed, and what was he doing before he became?
Well, he was 27. It took him a while to get started. I did find some writings that he did when he was a USC student that show you that the sensibility was there on the printed page. He bounced around quite a bit. He sold cars at one point. He was a guy that was trying to get up at intermission in various clubs down here and talking to the crowd, which was tough to do, get their attention when the musical act was off stage. He followed the Stan Kenton band around. Kenton occasionally would let him get up on stage in between numbers and talk for a few minutes. But he really didn't find himself until he had a regular venue, and that was the Hungry Eye in San Francisco. He started there in December 1953, and it took him a while to catch on, but when he did, he became a sensation. It was all word of mouth. I think that as he developed the confidence that he could get through to the crowd and that the crowd would respond to the types of things that he had to say, that he developed a level of confidence and a character emerged, and I think that's what carried him to the next level.
Well, he didn't do mother-in-law jokes, so what was his material like in 1952?
Well, it was Joe McCarthy, it was Richard Nixon, who was the newly elected vice president, it was Eisenhower to a degree, it was Adlai Stevenson, it was observational things also. Mort came up the same year as Playboy magazine and Hugh Hefner, so he could also talk about sports cars, hi-fi, the things that were engaging guys that were, especially guys that were educated on the GI Bill and were out to, you know, scratch out the American dream, get a house and a car and a wife and have 1.6 children and, you know, get to a certain point where it registers on them that perhaps their goals aren't as solid as they thought. And you're getting into the mode of thinking that comes with a man in the gray flannel suit, the idea that you've had positions of authority and command in battle, and you come back, go to college, get yourself a routine job, start making that kind of money, and then the next climb up the ladder is so that you can buy a better class of vodka, you know, that sort of thing. And Mort was the first guy to really illuminate that kind of mindset, I think. Lenny Bruce did it to a lesser degree later. When Mort started, Lenny Bruce was doing movie parodies and imitations, things like that. But Mort was the first guy who not only weaved politics into the discourse, but also lifestyle issues, what they were seeing and reading about, and how to satirize that in a way that resonated with these audiences. I think, again, you know, there was nobody else doing that at that time. The top comedians of the day were people like George Gobel and Jackie Gleason, and then, as I mentioned, Bob Hope. Mort was something else again.
Well, James Curtis, Mort Saul, the subject of your new book, Mort Saul and the Birth of Modern Comedy, his comedy style was, you know, we think of those 80s comedians as standing in front of the brick wall, and he was like the very first one to stand in front of a brick wall.
Yeah, he was. That was in 1954 in San Francisco. The Hungry Eye originally started as a basement place in a Flatiron building that's still standing there, incidentally. Francis Coppola owns it now. And they couldn't accommodate the crowds once more caught on, and so they moved across the street to a brick and concrete building. And Banducci went to work downstairs to create a showroom, and he took it back. He was sandblasting the walls and took it back to the brick. And Mort said one night, what are you going to put there? And he said, I'm going to leave it like that. And everybody, all the clubs copied that in time. It was a brilliant idea. And so the first club to do that was Hungry Eye.
Well, Mort Sahl's style seemed as though he were making it up as he went along. Was that the case?
Only to the extent that he was putting things together. I think of it kind of like he had a mind full of kindling, and every night, every performance, he had a different way of building the fire. He had the same fuel, the same ammunition, but the way he put those things together varied from night to night. And he was also brilliant at ad-libbing, so if you had the toolbox and you had the Mo going, then it could go off in all kinds of directions. Dick Cavett described to me the first time he saw Mort in New York City, and he said it was like watching a painter who would paint a little bit of the picture up here, and then a little bit of the picture over here, and then more of the picture down below, and then over to this corner. And you begin slowly to see how all those individual divergent parts started to come together, and what you had finally was a brilliant abstract painting. So part of the success, what Mort did, was not so much the result as the getting there, how he could go off on a variety of different subjects, say brilliant things about them, and come back to the core point, and at the end of it all, leave you with something that was really nourishing. I think he did that again and again. And for audiences that tuned into that, who could appreciate that, there is nothing else like a Mort Sahl performance.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with James Curtis. He's the author of Last Man Standing, Mort Sahl and the Birth of Modern Comedy. Before the break, we were talking about the style of Mort Sahl's comedy, which, well, it seems that that kind of performance would not really lend itself to comedy albums, and yet, you know, I guess he was, would you say, the first to make those kind of comedy albums?
Pretty much. He was, comedy albums before that, now, there may have been some party albums, like, say, for instance, the Red Fox albums that did this, but in terms of mainstream recordings, Mort's recordings were the first to be done in a live venue where you had the audience response and you were in an intimate club environment. Up to that point, comedy albums were done in the studio and there was no reaction. They were done like movies in the sense that the laughter would be supplied by the people who were listening to the album at home. So Mort was the first one to record with an audience in a club. That happened initially in 1955 in a Dave Brubeck concert date in Carmel, California. And that was a bootleg. It wasn't issued until after Mort's first official album, which was on the Verve label, called The Future Lies Ahead in 1958. Once he did it, Lenny Bruce came along, Nichols and May, Shelley Berman, etc., and they did the same thing. Jonathan Winters was another one. Mort was always kind of a cult figure. Shelley Berman was very mainstream and sold a lot better than Mort did for Verve. But Mort was, again, the first. In fact, he was instrumental in bringing Shelley Berman and Jonathan Winters both to Verve Records at that time.
Well, of course, Shelley Berman's pieces, which were almost always a guy talking on the telephone, long before Bob Newhart was talking on the telephone.
Yeah, that's true.
They were short, I mean, maybe 11 or 12 minutes, but I mean, you could isolate them and play them. I think there's even a greatest hits record of some of those Verve albums. Well, you couldn't do that with Mort Sahl.
No. Mort took an idea and ran with it. And really the difference is, and I realized this as I started studying Shelley Berman a little bit more and had the chance to talk with him. Shelley Berman's background was that he was a classical Shakespearean actor, and apparently a pretty good one. And so when Shelley Berman performed on stage, initially he was with the Compass in Chicago with Mike Nichols and Elaine May, and he would get these ideas, these improv ideas, which wouldn't go anywhere because he didn't have anybody to partner with. Elaine May was working with Mike Nichols. So he figured out how to do a two-hander by himself with a telephone. But he was good enough at it that he was one of these guys that never had to repeat what the person was supposedly saying at the other end of the phone, which you see a lot with people are pretending they're on the telephone. He never did that because he was a good actor. You knew what the person on the other end was saying without him having to repeat it. Shelley Berman did little playlets, and there's a great bit that he did on one of his early albums, for instance, where he checks into a hotel room and then gets on the phone to the desk clerk to explain to him that there is no window in the room. And then it gets more and more confining, and he can't find the door. It's wonderful stuff, surrealistic stuff, but it goes more to his ability as an actor and as an improvisational comedian than to anything that he did in terms of monologue. Mort was, I think, completed by the audience, which of course varied with every performance, every set. And I think that's one of more the keys to appreciating Mort and understanding his how he varied from performance to performance. He keyed off the crowd, and the crowd was as much a part of the performance as Mort was.
Well, I know many comedians, I don't know about Shelley Berman, but I know many comedians employed writers. What about Mort Saul? Did he ever employ any writers?
No, not really. The very few people who wrote for Mort were in television situations. Dick Cavett wrote for Mort a bit. Woody Allen co-wrote Mort's one TV special for NBC. So on occasion, on rare occasions such as that, he had writers, but usually, no, everything came out of his own mind. And that's another remarkable aspect of his life and work, is that I think he was pretty much unique in not having writers to feed him material. One of the things I think that occurred to me as I was working through this was Mort was one of those comics that did not have to worry about having material stolen from him, because nobody else could be affected with his stuff other than he.
I was watching It's a Gift the other night, the W.C. Fields movie.
Yes.
It's so funny, and it's just as funny. I mean, it's probably funnier now than it was when it came out. It's a marvelously funny work of art.
Is.
Well, you know, W.C. Fields wasn't working with a newspaper. He wasn't thinking about the current events so much in his work, but Mort Saul was. So does Mort Saul's work, do his comedy albums and his early work hold up?
They do if you know who he's talking about. I think that's one of the tricks of really reviewing his work and also in appreciating it, is knowing who he was talking about and what the surrounding social and political environment was at that time. It's tough these days to convey to people what it was like back during the Red Scare days of the mid-1950s. And what a looming figure McCarthy was, and some of the other people who were in the Eisenhower cabinet at that time, besides Nixon, Ezra Taft, Benson, people like that. What you get from the early albums, especially in the recordings, are a sense of electricity, a sense of energy that carries them. And even when you don't know exactly who he's talking about, you at the same time have a good sense of what he's getting at. And I think that carries the day. One of the things that made people feel good about a Mort Saul performance, I think, was the idea that he elevated you to his level. He gave you credit for knowing what he was talking about, even if you didn't fully talk about understand who he was talking about. You could go along with him, and you could get enough of it. I think it was considered uncool not to laugh at Mort Saul and what he had to say, even if you weren't sure what he was talking about in all instances. It felt good. A lot of comedians, especially these days, drag you down to their level. Mort elevated you to his level, and I think that was one of the secrets to his success and his appeal among a certain group of the audience who were well-informed and read newspapers and magazines like Time and Newsweek and who were really a Playboy and who were on top of events and could understand the points he was making. I think that's why he didn't fully catch on television ever, is because he was such a specialized taste. He was like a certain kind of fruit or vegetable that doesn't appeal to everybody, but if you enjoyed the taste of it, or if you learned, if he was an acquired taste and you acquired that taste, he was somebody that you could be absolutely evangelical about. A lot of his fans were just fanatical. They loved attending his live performances, and as I got to be of age in the 70s and 80s, I went and sought Mort's performances out. And that's when he wasn't all that popular anymore, but I still enjoyed them very much.
Well, television, I mean, there's a difference between talking to 300 people and talking to 300 million people. I mean,
yes, absolutely.
Television kind of confined him, I guess.
Television confined him. He had a better... Network television was tough for him, and he was most successful, I think, as a guest on talk shows, the Cabot Show, the Tonight Show, you know, Joey Bishop, Steve Allen, you can go down the list. He was on a lot, and he was good at doing, you know, the 10 or 12 minute back and forth with the host, and having something to say that was provocative and interesting and could, in effect, gauge a response or elicit a response from the 230 people who were in the audience in the studio. And that was like a club date for him. The fact that the cameras were looking on was, almost meaningless. I think that when he had a show locally here on Channel 11, it was the same sort of thing. Because it was a local show, he could get down to local topics in the same way that he could if he were appearing at the Hungry Eye and talk about San Francisco-related topics. There was an intimacy that would form with the audience. And I think that turned out to be one of the best things about his time on television, was the idea that he could turn a TV show on Friday nights into kind of a club date of sorts. And really, for a while, the ratings were just through the ceiling. They expanded the length of his program from 90 minutes to 2 hours. He had an improvisational group. It was kind of a very crude early version of Saturday Night Live in a way, and he became, I think, a standard for creativity on local television in Los Angeles in the mid-60s.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking tonight with James Curtis. He's the author of a new biography of Mort Saul. It's called Last Man Standing, Mort Saul and the Birth of Modern Comedy. Well, Mort Saul was not initially a huge fan of President Kennedy. He was kind of a Kennedy critic to a certain extent. And then the assassination of President Kennedy really affected him.
Yeah, it did. More so than I thought at first. He dropped out of sight for a while, Mort. I think to a certain degree, political comedy was considered to be in poor taste after the assassination. There's a kinescope at UCLA of a Steve Allen show that Mort did in early 1964, about 4 months after the assassination. And it's shocking to watch it in the sense that Mort's working off of index cards. He had never done that before in a performance, and there he is, really not connecting with the audience. He was really thrown off a tremendous amount by that event. And I think there was a real hunger to try to make sense of it as it went forth. And when the Warren Commission report was published, it gave him a chance to lock on to something and try to make sense of what he had experienced, you know, why he reacted the way he did, I think. And also... then the conspiracy theory started, and he met Jim Garrison in New Orleans, and became convinced that the assassination, the murder of the president, was the result of a conspiracy of some sort, that it couldn't have happened any other way in his mind. And I think because of that, he really went off into a dark place in terms of how he was managing his career, and as a result, he alienated a large portion of his audience for a while.
Well, he stopped being funny.
He stopped being funny because he became so dogmatic about the theories that were being bandied about at that point. This is where I think his fascination with Hollywood movies comes into play to some degree, since he absorbed them on such a relentless level for so many years. When he was at an impressionable age, he and his family moved to Los Angeles in 1935. The production code had really just taken effect, and it was Hollywood's view of America as put forth to the rest of the world that he embraced. And in any even mediocre movie, there's always a reason for everything. There's basic plotting that was enforced throughout the universe in terms of how one wrote and brought forth a Hollywood movie. And so the kind of senseless act that was an assassination of a political figure like John Kennedy, or later Martin Luther King or Robert Kennedy, there had to be some sort of structural, logical reason for why it happened. Madness was not necessarily a reason. Madness was not an excuse for this. And I think his thinking, when it went along those lines, naturally led to conspiracy. It was the way that he saw the world, and that there had to have been a force, a system, a way of getting something done that was behind this heinous act, and he was going to find out who was behind it. And he also saw conspiracy in other aspects of his life, like his inability to get a job sometimes. So that was an aspect of him that was not attractive to some people, and when he got off on topics like that and wouldn't let up is when he started to make enemies of not only the audience in some cases, but station management on radio and television.
Did you find any evidence, James Curtis, of a conspiracy to keep Mort Saul off the air?
No. No. One of the things that happened, and I think it goes along with the timing to some degree, is that a change in the tax code was contemplated that would rein in entertainment tax deductions, the sorts of things that expensive restaurants and nightclubs kind of fed off of. This was during the Kennedy administration, and it set off a panic throughout the industry. And prominent night spots closed as a result of this, just in terms of fear that the audience wasn't going to be there anymore because the enabling tax deductions weren't going to be there. The business entertainment deductions weren't going to be there. So places like Romanoff's in Los Angeles and the Crescendo, Mort's home away from home down here in Los Angeles, they closed in '63 before the assassination. And Mort for years in the kind of mythology that sometimes just kind of grows out of a situation, felt it was the Kennedy administration that was targeting him, old man Kennedy in particular, because he wouldn't let up on the Kennedys. But really it was more of an economic situation where the clubs were in a position where they couldn't survive any longer, that it wasn't a favorable economic environment. It's amazing when you look at the period in the late 50s and early 60s here in Los Angeles, the amount of talent that was available in the days before Las Vegas became the juggernaut that it became in the later 60s and beyond. If you were to be on the Sunset Strip on a given night in the late 50s, I mean, you'd have Mort or Lenny Bruce at the Crescendo or at the Interlude upstairs, Duke Ellington and his band. Down the street would be Sammy Davis Jr. At the Coconut Grove, you'd have Judy Garland. I remember one time Mort got ill. He was supposed to go into the Crescendo, and he got ill 2 days ahead of time and had to drop out. He was in the hospital. And on 24 hours' notice, Gene Norman, who ran the Crescendo, was able to get to replace him, the vocalist June Christie, and Mike Nichols and Elaine May. And that was for a two-drink minimum, a $2 cover. So it was a marvelous time for entertainment and for nightlife in the major cities. And it all went away after about 62, 63. It was gone by the mid-60s.
We need a time machine, James Curtis. Where is it?
Yes, we do. That's true.
Let's go back and go to those clubs. And in San Francisco, too.
Yeah, that's true, you know.
Well, I was kind of surprised in your book, Mort Sahl, Last Man Standing, that Mort Sahl had so many acting appearances. I mean, I knew he had acted occasionally, but he acted a lot. What? How do you rate him as an actor, and what are some of the best things out there to watch?
Well, he wasn't that good an actor, I'm afraid. He was best when he could write his own material. He's a breath of fresh air in the first movie he ever made, which is called In Love and War, because it's such a ponderous thing otherwise. They pretty much let him write his own stuff for that. So he's the only comedy relief you have in the movie. He's in things like Johnny Cool, where he plays a henchman, and it was essentially a one-day cameo. He's good in Don't Make Waves, which is a comedy from the mid-60s, directed by Alexander McKendrick. One of the best things he did a thriller episode, the anthology series hosted by Boris Karloff. He's good in that, I think. One of the best things he did, though, was a TV pilot that nobody has seen. They have it at UCLA. It's called Joe and Josie. And it was going to be a regular half-hour series. And it was Mort Sahl as a cab driver and Cloris Leachman as his hairdresser wife. And their daily struggles to get by. It was a comedy drama envisioned as such, and written by Garson Kanin, with Ruth Gordon, his wife, did some remarkable screenwriting in the late 40s and early 50s, including a couple of the great Spencer Tracy Catherine Hepburn films. So it had a great pedigree, and Mort is very good at it, and he plays very well with Cloris Leachman, whom he knew. And it's too bad that it didn't sell. That's among his best work, I think.
Well, Cloris and Mort are still around, so maybe they'll put it on the fall schedule.
That's true. And they're both about the same age. As you know, Mort just turned 90 earlier this year.
Yes, and they're both pretty sharp.
Yeah, they sure are. I just talked to Mort a few minutes ago.
And so what is he doing now? Is he still performing? What is his
take? Yeah, he performs up in Mill Valley at the Throckmorton Theater every Thursday night, and they stream it live on Periscope. And he usually picks up somewhere between 300 and 700, maybe even 1,000 viewers. So, that's the same kind of audience that back in the days of the Hungry Eye, they'd see maybe 300 in that room, or the crescendo would seat about 400. And so every week he's getting about that size of an audience. It's just the technology enables it now.
And he's a 90-year-old grad student in his sweater and newspaper?
Yeah, he's still wearing the pullover sweater, and major concession to his advanced years is he sits down when he talks. He doesn't stand at the microphone, but he said something recently because he had a stroke a few years ago, and so he uses a cane to get around, and he'll sit down. But he said as he was coming into the room one night, the pianist was playing a Duke Ellington tune as his entry music. And Mort stopped halfway to the chair and looked at the audience and said, hey, don't you think he should be playing Don't Get Around Much anymore?
Yeah, so does Mort do a lot of topical humor? What is his view of the current administration?
Oh, God. Well, yeah, he definitely has a lot to say. And I think as much as anything, he likes to tweak the audience a bit also. He always said that when people accuse him of being either a Democrat or a Republican, he says, I'm neither, I'm a radical. And if you visit him in his home, you'll see that he has a Che Guevara doll on one of the bookcases. And he was always a fervent admirer of Fidel Castro's. So he's not easy to box up and pin to a particular political persuasion, and he's always taken a great deal of pleasure, let's say, in making audiences uncomfortable, and so those instincts are still well intact to this day.
Well, as usual, we've just skimmed the surface of one of your books, since your books are so in-depth, and that's what makes them great. But before we go, what are you going to do next? What's your next project?
Well, I'm at work on a biography of Buster Keaton right now.
Oh, that'll be fun.
I wasn't necessarily going to go back to film again, but this subject kind of landed in my lap, and this is a case of a subject that's been done several times, but not as well as it should be, in my opinion. So I'm taking a fresh look at Keaton. And
will you do his whole life from childhood through?
Yeah, death? Yeah. It'll be a cradle to grave thing. But I'm especially focusing on his standing as a filmmaker, not just as a in front of the camera comic, but a guy who knew how to shoot and cut comedy about as well as anybody alive, and how he developed that particular skill, and how he was able to create a body of work that is still remarkable to this day. I mean, just recently down here in Southern California, there was a presentation of The General, one of the great films he wrote and directed and starred in from 1926, and it had a full symphony orchestra accompanying it, and it was a sold-out event. And it got an amazing response from the audience. It worked exactly as well as it must have back in 1926 when it was first shown to audiences. So that, you mentioned, it's a gift. See that with a big audience, a big modern audience. It does just as well, beautifully. And so it's always fun and interesting to look at timeless pieces of work like that and dig into them a bit and take the watch apart and see how it works. And so that's what I'm going to be doing with Keaton.
Well, I look forward to reading it, and I hope you'll come back and talk to us about it on From the Bookshelf.
I'd love to do that.
This book is called Last Man Standing, Mort Saul and the Birth of Modern Comedy. The author, my guest, James Curtis. Thanks so much for spending some time talking to us on From the Bookshelf.
Good talking to you too, Gary. Thank you.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, James Curtis. His latest book is called Last Man Standing, Mort Saul and the Birth of Modern Comedy. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next time. I don't know.